Madam Chair, members, George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services. I've brought a high-level summary of our forecast changes. On the first page is a summary of the changes in the bottom line to the general fund, all of our general fund programs. The basic story of our general fund forecast is that it has been stable.
Bill takes care of us.
If you look at the page, all of the pages are laid out in the same way. There is a column for the 06-07 biennium, 08-09 biennium, and the next biennium. And then end-of-session projections, end-of-session 06, and then the November forecast and the change in November from the end of session and the percentage change. And then the February forecast, the change between November and February, percentage change in February, and then the February change from end of session, so that you can see the bottom line change from the end of session 06 to where we are now. Practically all of these forecast changes are 1% or less. We had a decrease in the November forecast, just under 1%, and then we had basically no change in the February forecast for the current biennium, but we had an increase for the 08-09 biennium and for the 10-11 biennium. And in the net, the change since end of session for the current biennium is a decrease of 1%. For the 08-09 biennium, it's an increase of 0.3%. Most of the 80 to 85% of the expenditures in our general fund programs occur in the medical assistance program. And so on the next page is the same information about the medical assistance forecast, which is the basic driver of the trends in the general fund forecast. And here again, you see a decrease in the November forecast in the neighborhood of 1%, hardly any change in the current biennium in the February forecast, and an increase of 1% in the 08-09 biennium. The changes in the November forecast mostly came out of slightly lower caseload forecasts in home and community-based waiver services, and also from reductions in the forecast for the alternative care program, where we have an arrangement that any unspent alternative care funds cancel to the medical assistance program. We overfund alternative care in the budget to ensure that when the money's distributed through allocations to the counties, that they can spend most of it, but we know because of how it's distributed, they're never going to spend all of it. And so from the start, we anticipate a cancellation to the medical assistance program. So that's a factor in the medical assistance forecast. The change in the February forecast, which was an increase for the 08-09 biennium, was mostly a change over higher hospital rates. Inpatient hospital rates are rebased every 2 years. Because of a legislative change, there was no rebasing in 2005. So the rebasing in 07 was a four-year update on the hospital rates. When the rebasing was done, and it's updating the base for the hospital rates from 1998 to 2002, and it's done as far back as it is because the Medicare cost reports have to be used, and that's the timing on which the Medicare cost reports become available. When the rebasing was done, it was found that that the medical assistance rates went up much more than we expected. And so that is the basic reason for the forecast increase over inpatient hospital rates.
And Mr. Hoffman, if you could just remind us, when does the new rebasing go into effect? So when will the hospitals be receiving that money?
The hospital rebasing is effective for admissions on or after January 1st, 2007. So it is already in effect. We had anticipated a rate increase of about 8% as a result of the rebasing. And after the work was done, we found that the increase was going to be approximately 26% instead of 8%.
And what is the increase value of that then, the dollar amount?
The increased value in the February forecast is about $40 million each year in fee-for-service rates, and that's the federal and the state dollars combined, plus additional costs that we anticipated in managed care rates, which is roughly $20 million each year.
And is that state and federal also?
That's also state and federal, Madam Chair.
So the increase in state dollars is about $30 million over what we anticipated?
The increase in state dollars for in medical assistance is about $57 million for the 2008-09 biennium.
Okay.
And some additional smaller costs in the GAMC program, about $10 million for the biennium in the GAMC program.
So it's about $67 million altogether?
That's correct, Madam Chair. The next largest program is the General Assistance Medical Care Program, and that's on page 3. And there, relative to the size of the program, we've had a greater forecast change. The increase in the November forecast is mainly from about a 5% increase in the caseload forecast. And the additional increase in February is around the inpatient hospital rebasing, as I mentioned, which is about $10 million of that change. And most of the rest of it comes from a change in our forecast about how many GAMC people were going to shift to the Minnesota Care Program. This is based on an 05 session change where a policy was adopted that we would move many GAMC enrollees over to the Minnesota Care Program after a few months of enrollment in the GAMC program, and we had anticipated that the average size of the group of people shifted out of GAMC into MinnesotaCare was going to be about 18,000. And in February, now that this has started in September, and we have some idea what's going on now, and we changed that number to approximately 17,000. So this change saves somewhat less in the GAMC program than we had anticipated at the end of session. And so that's the cause of part of the increase in the GAMC forecast. When you add together medical assistance and GAMC, they account for close to 90% of our expenditures in the general fund. So on page 4, I have a summary of the rest of the general fund programs. And there isn't a lot of net change here to explain. The decrease in the 06-07 biennium since end of session adds up to $14 million. Most of that comes from a change in the forecast for the CD entitlement, where we're forecasting a lower caseload than we were at the end of session. Otherwise, there is little change on the bottom line. As always, there are stories about changes among the pieces, but I assume the committee would like the short version this morning. So,
I think so.
Okay, MinnesotaCare, of course, is not in the general fund, and that's on the fifth page of this handout. And here we have a greater forecast change, and the underlying cause of the forecast change is that enrollment in the MinnesotaCare program has been declining for a few years, and it's been continuing to decline month by month. And so our forecast in November and in February basically has been a forecast that the enrollment in the program is near the level where it's going to stay, and it's going to level off at about the level it's at. But as it keeps falling, as months go by, then our forecast has been getting lower. In total, the expenditure forecast since the end of session is down 9.7% for the current biennium and is down 14% for the next biennium. Our forecasts of enrollment in the MinnesotaCare program are down for families with children, down about 8% for the current biennium and about 20% for the next biennium. For adults with no children, the forecast is down 7% for the current biennium and 18% for the next biennium. So on the whole, we have an enrollment forecast which is almost 20% lower than we had at the end of session. There are other technical changes around. We're forecasting movement in and out of MinnesotaCare. One part is the GAMC shift that I mentioned. That's a shift from GAMC into MinnesotaCare, and that is a policy-driven shift driven by changes made in the law. The other shift that we're anticipating is from MinnesotaCare into medical assistance, and that's a movement which we're anticipating in the future when the new health match system goes up, that it will cause numerous people children and parents to shift out of MinnesotaCare into medical assistance. And there have been changes in that area too, but they tend to offset each other, and so that's basically the story in Minnesota Care.
Question, Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffman, what does Health Match have to do with people shifting from Minnesota Care to medical assistance?
We have, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Sullen, about half of the child and parent enrollees in the Minnesota Care program could equally be on the medical assistance program. Their income is low enough that they could be on medical assistance instead. There are probably, ever since we have had a federal waiver that pays half of the cost for the children and parents in Minnesota Care, we have not had any policy that said if you can be on medical assistance, you have to be there. So people have a choice, or there is a large group of people who have a choice and who are on the Minnesota Care program could be on medical assistance. We are anticipating that when the new system is put in place, that it will tend to assign these people to the medical assistance program. And they will still be able to say, no, I don't want to go to medical assistance. I want to be on Minnesota Care. But we're assuming most of them, since there are some advantages for the children, the main advantage is that MA is free. Since there are some advantages, the system is intended to be programmed to assign people preferentially to the program which is the most advantageous for them.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffman, how do you account then for the almost 10% drop in enrollees in Minnesota Care?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Sullen, we think that through a series of changes over several years, that the Minnesota Care program has become less attractive, harder to get into, and harder to stay on. We've had some increases in premiums. Going all the way back to the summer of 2002, which is when Minnesota Care enrollment had been growing until the summer of 2002. Then it stopped growing for about a year, and then it started falling. And what changed in 2002 is we adopted a higher income standard in medical assistance. And so it is likely that the higher income standard in medical assistance picked up some children who would have been on the Minnesota Care program. And then in 2003, we adopted higher premiums, and it was a significant increase in the neighborhood of 10% for the families above 100% of the poverty level. And we've also adopted additional verification requirements at a couple of different points, and the application has become longer. And we think the combination of all those things that have happened have made the program less attractive.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Hoffman, where are these people going? Are they just uninsured?
Some are going to medical assistance.
But that's decreasing also.
No. Enrollment in medical assistance has been increasing.
No.
And if we looked at the total enrollment of children and parents in medical assistance and in Minnesota Care. We don't have enrollment figures in front of us here. But if you looked at the total enrollment of children and parents in both programs, you would see a slow, continuous rise over that period. And so it's not very obvious, but it makes sense that there has been some amount of diversion of children and parents to the medical assistance program.
Mr. Hoffman, didn't we, in fact, decrease eligibility for the medical assistance program?
Only for the 1 to 2 year old auto-borns.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, we increased income eligibility for children to 170% of poverty in, I think it was the summer of, I think it was fiscal 02, the summer of 01. And then we rolled it back to 150% of poverty a couple years later.
And
the other change, which the chair referred to, was we shortened the period of automatic eligibility for newborns from 24 months to 12 months.
And what I can tell you, Senator Prettner-Solon, is originally there were a lot of people that preferred to enroll in Minnesota Care because it was not viewed as a welfare program. You didn't have to go to the county to apply. You could apply directly to the state. And because there was a premium payment contribution based on a reasonable expectation of ability to pay, people felt like it was more of a program that they felt comfortable applying for. But over the years, what we have done is make people feel like criminals to apply for the program. And I've gotten letters from people. The most recent one was a man who said he's been desperately trying to keep his daughter on Minnesota Care, but it has become almost a full-time job for him because he has to run around to her employers and try and get all this stuff that the department needs. And then if there's one little thing that's not right or missing, it's like Monopoly. You do not pass go. The department does not process your application, and you have to start all over again. And you never know how long it's going to take them to tell you that you didn't do everything exactly right. So in the meantime, you're waiting, and in the meantime, then you're falling off of the program. Other questions? Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to take you back to this forum again, where you're describing, if you're saying as Minnesota Care enrollees went down and Minnesota Care moved up, the people moved over because there were more benefits or eligibility increased for them. When I look at this medical assistance forecast, it looks like the forecast is that the requirement for expenditures is going to go down.
Well, it's a total medical assistance program, though. It includes nursing home, waiver slots. I mean, it's the whole 85% of the budget. It's not just medical assistance for families with children.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But why that sort of surprises me that overall that the demand for medical assistance dollars is going to be going down. What is contributing to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what I've described is how our forecast has moved, which is if we go back to the medical assistance page, it's down a tiny bit for the 08-09 biennium, 0.3%. But if you look at the February expenditure forecast, you see a forecasted state expenditure, which is going up about 17% biennium over biennium. So we are still forecasting substantial annual growth in expenditures in the program. And the children and parents do not account for a large share of the expenditures in the program. Most of the expenditures in the program are for long-term care services and for the medical needs of the disabled and the elderly.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Hoffman. Now we will turn to the governor's change pages. Jane Hardwick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jane Wilcox Hardwick, Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services, and I will walk through fairly briefly the supplemental budget update pertaining to the Human Services budget that was released by the governor last week. I believe you were provided a packet of materials about a half inch thick with
They're
some
in
blue
your
and
books.
Pink paper.
If you turn to page A52, it's the next page. There, A52 is the last of these green pages.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The materials are color-coded to distinguish between those proposals that are either new proposals in the governor's budget or have a substantive change in them, and those are highlighted in pink, and those proposals in blue that are more technical in nature, simply repricing of pages based on the new forecast or some technical changes to the information that had been presented in the original budget. I'd like to focus on those areas that are new proposals. The first item is a proposal that is on page 22 of that packet, entitled Healthcare Enrollment Transfer. This particular proposal, in follow-up to Mr. Hoffman's testimony, relates to the transition of families with children from the Minnesota Care Program to the Medical Assistance Program under the new enrollment system. The cost of those individuals are currently being paid for in the Healthcare Access Fund. The forecast in projecting that that population will move to medical assistance would then shift the cost of those individuals to the general fund. This particular proposal would fund those individuals, continue to fund the health care for those individuals out of the Health Care Access Fund, and that would be done with the transfer from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund in the total amount of $43.9 million in fiscal year 08-09 and $143 million in 10 and 11. Happy to answer any questions on that proposal.
Ms. Hardwick, this does seem like it's just shifting, refinancing healthcare access funds into the general fund. I mean, the healthcare access fund was never intended to pay for Medicaid people. The fact that we have been doing it and these people are figuring out that they're better off in the medical assistance program, the fact that we've been doing it for a number of years has been a benefit to the general fund. But the Healthcare Access Fund was really intended not to pay for general fund programs, but to pay for uninsured people who otherwise would not have access to our general fund programs. So maybe you could just explain to me why transferring money from the Healthcare Access Fund to pay for Medicaid is a good idea.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the context here is that these individuals are currently being paid for in the Healthcare Access Fund and would be continued to be paid for out of the Healthcare Access Fund if it were not for an enrollment system change that would occur.
Well, we don't really know that. I mean, they are shifting over by themselves prior to the enrollment system change anyway.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And the transfer amount would change depending on what the actual forecasted change is at the time that it occurs.
Any questions on this item? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I guess I would just like to also indicate my bewilderment to why we would, if we have eligibility criteria for one category of people and we have based on their income and we have eligibility criteria for another category of people, it seems to me, and we've defined rules in the past for which, how we fund based on the category, these different categories, that if people become poor, for example, and become eligible for the Medicaid program, or it just makes no sense to have the dollars follow the people. It seems the dollars, to me, should follow the program because that's the way they were designed to begin with.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think while that is our typical construct around medical assistance in Minnesota care, there have been instances in the past decade where we have funded for medical assistance expenditures out of the Healthcare Access Fund for folks who are eligible for medical assistance, and I believe vice versa at one time related to pregnant women.
I don't think it's ever been vice versa.
Madam Chair, I misspoke that.
Funny thing there. But speaking of vice versa, how many people, and we might need Mr. Hoffman to come back up and help you, how many people after Health Match goes into effect are we anticipating staying in the Healthcare Access Fund who otherwise would be eligible for medical assistance?
I will defer to Mr. Hoffman.
What are they saying?
Madam Chair, we're by fiscal year 2011, we're anticipating 38,000 people who we think would otherwise be in the Minnesota Care Program will be in medical assistance instead, and our estimate for that time period is that 90% of them will have moved, and so the 38,000 corresponds to 90% of the children and parents in Minnesota care who we estimate are also eligible for the medical assistance program. So that would leave 3,000 or 4,000 children and parents in the Minnesota Care Program who could be in the medical assistance program. Now, I don't need to point out to the chair that this is this forecast is based on an estimate about what share are going to move.
Any other questions on this budget, on this change page? Did the governor spend this money on anything, or is this just luring us into the sinful tendencies of the department's budget?
Madam Chair, I'll leave that. I'm not aware of any particular direction that those expenditures have taken.
So the governor is not spending this money. This is just a suggestion for us if we want to.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. In regard to the human services budget, there was not an associated increase in human services expenditures.
Do you know if it was spent anywhere else?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of the decision-making around the other components of the budget.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, may I ask you your question that you're asking, if I could have you speak more directly to what it is that you're pointing out here. I think it's an important point, and I'd like you
well,
to speak
publicly. Well, this creates some revenue in the general fund. Obviously, it's a transfer from the Healthcare Access Fund. So I was asking Ms. Hardwick if the governor also is recommending spending it somewhere.
In healthcare.
Anywhere. Or if it's just a refinancing suggestion in case we were feeling a little short of money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that was that transferring out of Minnesota, out of the Healthcare Access Fund to support things other than what it was intended for has been an issue for us throughout all the hearings that we're having.
Did I state it clearly enough this time? Okay.
It was clear, but I just really want to make it really clear.
Okay. Shall we move on then?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next new proposal is on page 24 of that packet, entitled Disproportionate Share Hospitals. This particular proposal is a recommended change in the methodology by which we claim disproportionate share hospital funding from the federal government in beginning in fiscal year 08 and continuing on into the future. Current law directs the department in fiscal year 08 to claim a portion of our federal Medicaid disproportionate share hospital match using certified public expenditures from Hennepin County Medical Center, Regents Hospital, and the University of Minnesota Medical Center. This proposal would, rather than using that particular methodology for claiming DISH match, use a methodology based on GAMC expenditures of the state, and first in fee-for-service, then in managed care, and then last in relation to a certified public expenditure by Hennepin County Medical Center. The proposal also would eliminate payments to hospitals that were under current law planned for 08 and 09 only and were contingent upon the receipt of disproportionate share hospital revenue related to the certified public expenditure claiming methodology. So in conclusion, the proposal would result in a savings, a combination of savings and revenue to the that benefits the general fund for about $23 million in 08-09 and $68 million in fiscal year 2010 and 11.
And what is the department's rationale for not allowing the hospitals to get the DISH money in 08-09?
Madam Chair, the administration has been concerned about continued growth in expenditures in our health care programs. The payments for hospitals in 08-09 are planned payments. They have not yet occurred, and they would be built on top of the rebasing hospital payment rate increases that occurred beginning in January.
You caught that, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I caught this. And when I initially read this, I was pleased in the fact that, you know, those times that we can maximize our federal match opportunities, I think that's a good direction for us to go. But it is troubling to me that as fast as we're seemingly trying to be efficient in that regard, that we are, for lack of any further explanation, it seems to me that we are taking money from those hospitals that is due to them. And I think to put this in perspective, I and a number of people at this table have done some work this session, particularly to address the impact that hospitals have faced in 2002, 2003, 2005. And while I sense that that there was some notion that perhaps there was some relief to be had in 08 and 09. Seemingly that is being suggested to be taken away too. So I don't see the connection between increasing health care costs and trying to balance that on the backs of the very providers that are providing those services. So I'm disappointed.
Some of us looked at the DSH money as a way of offsetting the cuts that were made in 05, and the totality of those cuts over the last really 5 years has been pretty large to the hospitals. And this did seem like, in a way of tough budget times, a way of generating some federal funding without having to actually come up with new state expenditures. It just... it does seem to me like it's... well, if we need to get money by cutting hospitals, we've certainly learned how to do it over the last 5 years without taking their DSH money.
Madam Chair, shall I move on?
Are there any other questions on this page? Okay, then let's go on.
Madam Chair, members, the next new proposal is on page 26, entitled Payments to Public Providers. This particular proposal is a bit unorthodox in terms of it being included and submitted as a budget page because there is no budget impact being booked at present, but because it stands to have a significant impact on the human services budget in the future, we thought it appropriate to bring it forward as a budget change item. Madam Chair and members, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services published a proposed regulation in mid-January that could have some very significant impact on our ability to claim federal Medicaid funding for certain payments to public providers. The regulation itself is proposed. In the proposal, the feds have indicated the intended effective date of September 1, 2007, but we do not yet have a final regulation before us. And so this proposal is being put forth in reaction to proposed regulations at this time. Again, a bit unorthodox, but given the potential magnitude of impact, we thought it important for us to bring this forward at this time. The regulation impacts medical assistance payments in four different manners. The first is that it narrows the definition of a public entity or a public provider who can participate in the non-federal share of our Medicaid program through an intergovernmental transfer or a certified public expenditure. It narrows it to entities that have our unit of government with taxing authority, a healthcare provider with taxing authority, or a provider if the unit of government with taxing authority is obligated by law to fund the provider's liabilities. So it narrows and more clearly defines the scope of providers that meet that criteria. We currently have some intergovernmental transfer and certified public expenditure arrangements in state law with entities that would probably and would very unlikely qualify under this new proposed definition. The second area where it impacts the medical assistance program is that it requires that expenditures to public providers be supported by a form of cost reporting. There is not significant definition around that cost reporting in the proposed regulation, but it does include that requirement. There are a number of providers in the medical assistance program for whom we do not currently require cost reports. That includes some providers do our rates are based to some degree on cost reporting, for example, hospitals, nursing homes. But there are another array of providers, for example, county home health providers, other home and community-based waiver providers that may be part of a county or city public health organization. And we do not currently require cost reporting of those entities, nor do we have at present a sense of the payment rates against their cost in terms of proportion. So if the regulation were adopted and we did not have cost reporting, and then the subsequent component here, the third item, is that our payments then must also be limited to cost. So if this proposal were not adopted, the regulation were put into effect where state law directs us to make payments based on a methodology in current state law, to the degree that that methodology exceeded the cost of those individual providers, the state would not be able to claim federal match on the marginal amount above the cost. And then the fourth area where there's an implication for the state's Medicaid program is that it requires that providers retain the full amount of the medical assistance payment in order for the full payment to be matched with federal funds. This potentially comes into play in areas where we have arrangements with providers and local units of government related to intergovernmental transfers. This is an area that's of concern to us in terms of the regulation because retain is not defined. It's not clear if, for example, a county and a hospital have an arrangement whereby the county provides certain overhead expenditures to the hospital and the hospital reimburses the county for those expenditures, whether that meets this definition of retention or not. So there's a lack of clarity around some of the direction here, but certainly significant implications for the state's budget. So our proposal at this time on the back of that page, page 27, includes three components. The first two would be contingent on the promulgation of federal regulations that we've referenced earlier. The first would require that providers that are units of government report their costs to us in a format that's determined by the department, and that format would be determined once we know what the federal requirements would be around that. The next would be to limit payments to providers based on the cost reflected in those cost reports. And then thirdly, the last component would be to revise the current law to ensure that existing transfers and certifications are contingent on the availability of federal funding, allowing the authority for us to discontinue transfers or certified public expenditures that do not meet the criteria established in the regulation once it's promulgated. Madam Chair, that's the essence of the proposal, and I'd be happy to.
Well, I can understand why you're asking for this page, but you know, it is pretty troubling to me to think that we're going to authorize changes in payments to providers and we don't know what it will be. We also don't know what happens to the money. What will happen to the money if we're making lower payments? Would it just then become a forecast item and we lose the money, or?
Madam Chair, that is the assumption on which this page is built, is if the proposal were adopted, the regulations promulgated, that the forecast would then address the changes in expenditures and revenues associated with both provisions.
Well, I don't know about everybody else, but I'm not very anxious in having any more money forecasted out of our budget. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I missed part of this discussion, but what is a provider that is a unit of government? I'm not sure what that definition is.
County.
The county?
A county would be a unit of government.
City public health would be another example.
County
nursing home.
City-owned nursing home, county-owned nursing home.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to page 25 for a minute, and I notice the huge cuts to hospitals again. I just can't believe that this can be proposed. What are we trying to do, put our hospitals out of business? Or just not give people health care? I don't understand this at all.
Well, we did have a discussion about that along those lines while you were gone. Ms. Hardwick, do we have any idea how much money we're talking about on this sort of vague change page?
Madam Chair, it's certainly not entirely clear, given the lack of definition in the proposed regulation. It is possible that the revenue associated with this that may not be viable under a new regulation could be in the neighborhood of $30 million per year. There would also be reductions to providers, payments that would be, there would also be reductions in payments to providers that we have not yet been able to estimate.
And do you have a list of potential providers that could be affected?
Madam Chair, we are in the process of assessing that. We don't historically track an array, particularly in the home and community-based waiver area, the array of providers and identify whether they are government or not. So we are surveying providers to try to assess the magnitude of the number of providers that would be potentially affected by this.
So when you get that list compiled, would you share it with us?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Well, any questions on this? Any other questions on this page? Let me just ask one other question. Are there any potential providers on the list that we are anticipating in the governor's budget being given increases this biennium? So that, you know, we'd be giving an increase and then kind of taking it away without knowing it on this page.
Madam Chair, the area where that comes to mind would be the continuing care payment adjustment, the 2% and 2% rate adjustment would be impacted.
And which type of facilities do you anticipate, or which type of providers do you anticipate might be affected?
I would suspect, Madam Chair, that it would include the county nursing homes that are part of that pool of providers, as well as county home and community-based waiver providers are the ones that come to mind.
And do we have some reason to believe that we're paying either of those groups of people more than the cost of providing the care?
Madam Chair, I think we're in a circumstance where we don't have enough information at present to determine that. And it would also be dependent, Madam Chair, on the definition of cost that the feds would establish.
And so when do we think we would know that?
Madam Chair, if the feds stick to the schedule identified in their proposed regulation, we should know sometime in the summer or very early fall. But it is certainly not clear that they will be able to stick with that schedule.
So it could be longer.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for you, I think. Do we require providers that are not units of government that are getting Medicare and Medicaid payments to report their costs?
I think I'll let Ms. Hardwick answer that question.
Madam Chair, Senator, there are some circumstances where we do require cost reporting for rate setting. One example would be federally qualified health centers. Another are inpatient hospitals where we use Medicare cost reports. There are a number of other providers for which cost reporting is used as well, for non-government providers as well as government.
Ms. Hardwick, what happens if we don't do this page?
Madam Chair, if we were to assume that the federal regulations were promulgated and we did not have language in place, there are a couple of things that would happen. One would be that we may be making payments under state law for which federal match is not available, and the general fund would essentially take the hit for that. In other circumstances,
but it would be money we've already budgeted.
We would have already budgeted the non-federal share, but if the federal revenue or federal share is not available at the same level as projected, we would not have budgeted the non-federal share at the level it would need.
Right. So there'd be a reduction in federal payment to a provider, but we'd be paying a state share that doesn't have a federal match.
Madam Chair, there are some circumstances. Some of the payments are contingent on federal match or are tied to federal match being available. In that case, we would just pay that provider the state share, and the provider's payment would be reduced. There are other cases where our payments are based, the methodology in state law is the total payment. So if the federal match is not available, the state would still have the obligation to make the total payment, and the general fund would make up the difference in the forecast.
Are we talking how much?
Okay. Very troubling page.
Two questions. Troubling book. More than one troubling page.
If I could just very briefly cover two other pages.
Yes.
Rather quickly, Madam Chair. The next pink page in the packet on page 62, the following two pages are revised from the earlier budget recommendations. And I mention these because they're a little bit different than the standard repricing associated with the forecast. The HIV/AIDS program and the Minnesota Security Hospital program are not traditional forecasted programs, but we have established institutionalized fiscal analysis around those on a schedule similar to the November and February forecast. And so in both instances, we have been able to identify that we would no longer require the level of resource that we had been requesting earlier. The HIV/AIDS insurance program funding page on page 62 would no longer request an increase in funding for that program. Our most recent fiscal estimates indicate that prescription drug rebate revenue that is dedicated to that program would be adequate to fund it at its projected need level through 09 and possibly through 11. But our current estimates are fairly solid through 09. And so this request would no longer include an increase in that program. Next, page 64, the Minnesota Security Hospital census adjustment. Similarly, our most recent census estimates based on more recent experience in admissions for the security hospital indicate that we could delay opening of a unit an additional year. Under the original proposal, we had the base had assumed that we would be opening a unit in fiscal year 08 and one in 09. The original governor's recommendation indicated that we could delay one of those units to 10. We are now, and so we would have a unit opening in 10 and 11, or excuse me, 9 and 10. And now, given the most recent information, we are indicate that we would need to open a unit in fiscal year 9 and then in fiscal year 11. And so additional savings was available in the tails as a result of that. So be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much. The Department of Health has an update on their governor's budget also. Margaret Kelly.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health. And we just have a few pages that have been revised in our budget. They are blue. I'm not sure where they are in your book. The very first page is the Health Department's Agency Overview, page 6.
So it's in the back of your Health Department section.
The one item in our budget that was impacted by the February forecast is funding for medical education. The PMAP carve-out is updated every time the Department of Human Services updates their Medicaid forecast. And so we had been holding about $37 million in our budget that would go through the Merck program from the PMAP carve-out, and that has been increased in the Medicaid forecast, a small amount in fiscal years 8 and 9 and up to about 50-some million in 10 and 11. 10 and 11. This item, of course, is going to be impacted by the federal promulgation of rules that Jane Hardwick mentioned in their budget page. So we don't know how that will impact PMAP carve-out in the future. That change is reflected on the fiscal pages that you have before you. The other change in our budget is not an actual change to our budget, but just a revised budget page, page 34, the Healthy Connections budget page. We have the same pages in our budget as in the Department of Human Services budget, and their numbers were updated because of the February forecast, and so the page in our budget was updated as well. It doesn't impact the pieces of the proposal that are the Department of Health, the Minnesota Insurance Exchange, and the Section 125 plans are still at the level they were with the initial recommendation.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are, Ms. Kelly, are these MERC payments?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. It's actually on page 6. It's about two-thirds of the way down the page under expenditures by fund, statutory appropriations under medical education and research. Yes. That line across reflects all of the MERC payments that we make.
And perhaps you can explain to me what the difference is from what was proposed originally.
Madam Chair, Senator, certainly. The estimates for what we'll spend in our MERC grant program are a little bit higher than we had anticipated in the November forecast, and that's because of DHS's Medicaid forecast and the amount of the Medicaid program that's carved out specifically for medical education. We had been holding about $37 million, and that grows to about $53 million in the February forecast in 10 and 11.
And is that targeted?
Madam Chair and Senator, it is carved out of the Medicaid payment specifically for medical education that's distributed through our grant program.
So it will go into the formula?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Any other questions for the Health Department? Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Ms. Kelly, I wonder if you'd like to offer comment on healthcare access. It just struck me that there's such a significant change in that amount.
Well, that's the governor's recommendation for his Healthy Connections program. We did review that when we went through the governor's budget originally. And they are financing that Healthy Connections proposal out of the Healthcare Access Fund.
Duly noted, that's the point that I wanted to reiterate.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, thank you very much, Commissioner Kelly. Senator Coring. Mm-hmm. Have your bill laid over. We'd like to take it first today. It's a different bill. You're getting so many scheduled, I can't keep
Madam Chair, it is a different bill. The bill that you were referring to is coming up tomorrow. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to the chair and thank you to the committee, and especially thank you to Senator Olson for being an author on this bill, which is extremely important. We all have regional EMS programs in our district, and there's 8 actually throughout the state. They coordinate all levels of EMS in each region. Regions have not received an increase since 1986. Now, if I'm correct on my math, that's over 20 years. That's a long time. To the base funding. It's funded by general fund dollars and seatbelt dollars. And this is good news, but bad news. The seatbelt dollars have drastically decreased. So that's telling me that people are putting their seatbelts on. So that's a good thing, but yet the funding going to this important program has decreased. Senate File 637 is requesting $100,000 per region, per biennium. $800,000 total in appropriation. So, Madam Chair, we do have the president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association here today who'd like to say a few words, and the Central South Central EMS director. And I would turn it over first to the president here for some comments.
And if either of your witnesses know how much seatbelt revenue has been lost, I think we'd be interested to know that.
Thank you.
Paul, maybe you want to hand those handouts out so they go around there. Madam Chair and members, for the record, Buck McAlpin, president of the Ambulance Association. And thanks, Senator Corian and others at this table for sponsoring this bill. In 1986, the federal government recognized that trauma care throughout the nation and EMS care was very uncoordinated. And through some federal block dollars back then, they funded regional emergency services programs throughout the 50 states. Of course, the problem is with the federal government is that money went away in about 1991. The state legislature picked up that funding and decided these eight regional EMS programs were very important to keep. And the eight of them in Minnesota, there's one in southwest Minnesota in Granite Falls, in Rochester, southeast Minnesota, in Mankato, the South Central EMS program. Mr. Stelter is the director of that. The Metro program. The Central, there's one in St. Cloud, West Central in Alexandria, Northwest in Bemidji. And then the Arrowhead region has one in Duluth. What the eight regional programs do, Madam Chair and members, is they coordinate all day-to-day activity, coordinations with hospitals, our communication system, the EMS delivery system, and make sure things go very well with trauma care, cardiac care, and how that whole system's coordinated. What the funding does ask for is they get $156,000 out of the general fund every biennium, and the rest of their funding, Mr. Stelter can talk about, comes from their seatbelt fines. We've noticed a drastic decrease in the seatbelt fines the last few years. In about the early 90s, with the combination of money, the regions operated at close to over $400,000. They do the same thing today, since all the way back in 86, with less money than they had back through 86 and 90. So this is why we brought this request forward this year. And Mr. Stelter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Stelter. I'm the director of the South Central Regional Program. I've been the director for about 10 years now, and when I look at when I first started with what we were dealt with improving and enhancing EMS within our regions, especially since 9/11, the regional programs have been taxed with numerous jobs and to be able to perform an integration of all agencies responding to man-made natural disasters. We continue to work with law enforcement, fire, EMS, to provide the best possible medical care we can out there in an emergent situation. As these tasks have increased and working with Homeland Security, HRSA, we do not see an increased funding to do those tasks. We continue to be stretched thinner and thinner. We've had to cut staff, reduce our programs, our education programs, our grants to providers in order to provide good quality care out there in a consistent manner throughout the state. The one thing with the regional programs is we're a very unique position to bring all agencies and all law enforcement, fire, and EMS together to respond to these natural and man-made disasters. We work with hospital preparedness programs, Homeland Security. We have to deal with behavioral health now on some issues. Interoperable communications is a huge issue that we'll be taking on now. Emergency management, local and state public health programs, Department of Public Safety. We can currently, with our next, we're currently in our RFP for the next 2 years. And not only have we, if you've seen according to the chart on the one page, the decrease in funding that we've seen with seatbelt dollars. And again, the seatbelt revenue is down because people are wearing their seatbelt, but it's also hurting us. With the current proposal that we have coming out, we're going to be losing another $79,000 in the next 2 years. We've had to take bare bones cuts in our programs. It's going to be very difficult to even maintain what we're trying to do now with the added tasks that we're being faced with. Interoperable communications is a huge issue right now that we have to deal with because we do have some federal regulations coming down regarding that. We have to be prepared to be able to address that situation. I can tell you firsthand from being through a couple tornadoes and a couple incidences in the last 6 months in our region, interoperable communications is paramount for an emergency response for the well-being of the citizens of the state. Thank you for your time.
And, Madam Chair, I could just say, if I could just say that, you know, I think we can see that these are the folks that are on the front line. And God forbid that we'd never have to call them for any of our family members or our, hopefully not for ourselves, but they're on the front line. They're there for us, and so I hope we can step up to the plate for them. And I would also say that I have another job. I for the last 5 years, I've worked for the Crow Wing County Coroner, and so I've worked closely with these folks when there's been tragedy, and I will just say they do a tremendous job, and so I'm hoping that we can possibly get this into the omnibus bill, Madam Chair. And we would stand for any questions.
Are there any questions? Do any of you gentlemen know how much annually you've lost in seatbelt revenue?
I know in the annually, if that second handout has the breakdown from the seatbelt dollars all the way through. The last, ending up this last fiscal year as we finish out our grant cycle, we're going to be down about $40,000 from projected.
$40,000 and then another $79,000?
Correct.
So over
$100,000. When we look at our where our funding was a number of years ago, you know, we had our budget cuts out of the general fund. We took that 10%, and you can see that with the Support Act, that continues to have dropped too. But we've seen a steady increase since fiscal year 2002, I believe it is. It's just been a steady decrease in the funding. We try to project it, but there's really no way that the state can project exactly what that revenue will be.
And have you handled those cuts by just spreading that across the eight regions equally, or?
Yeah, all funding, whether it comes from the general fund or from the seatbelt dollars, is split individually to all eight regions, so we all get the same amount of dollars. Well, what the eight regional programs have tried to do is to share resources, content of programs, so we're not continue to reinvent the wheel. We continue to try to work together to reduce those costs, but the delivery of care in the Arrowhead region can be completely different than in my region because of resources available, population levels, that type of thing. So each region has to adapt to their local area and how to respond to those things.
And Madam Chair, if I could just say one thing, you know, this is $800,000 over the biennium, so that's $400,000 a year. And if I'm I was never really that good at math, but my math is correct, that's only $50,000 a year per region. So that's a pretty modest increase, I would say.
Modest when you start out, but everything adds up, doesn't it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, I would just also like to reiterate the importance of the emergency medical service programs to rural communities. As Senator Coring knows, in my private life before I came to the Senate, I also had a lot of contact with people working in emergency medical services and saw firsthand sometimes the lives that are not just impacted, but lives that are saved by people working in emergency medical services. And our rural communities are really dependent on these programs, and so I just also like to encourage us to, I know that the budgeting challenges we face, but just like to emphasize again with Senator Coring how important these programs are to our rural communities.
So Madam Chair, if there's no further questions, I would so move that Senate File 637 be laid over for possible inclusion or for
possible
certain
inclusion.
All right.
Good try.
Got to try.
At this stage, everything is everything is still possible.
Okay.
Very shortly, we'll find out how much is impossible.
Okay.
You've heard the motion. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Fischbach.
Thank you.
We have about an hour, and so we were hoping especially to focus in on certain sections of the bill.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, we did get the memo that you had handed, so we will be focusing on those issues. The one thing is we do have an amendment, I believe it's Senator Rosen's bill. Let's see, Senate File 1567. So if I could offer that as an author's amendment, what this is going to do is ensure that the bill has conforming policy language to that Senate File 1567. Do you guys don't have it? The numbers on it are AO7-0282.
I think we're handing it out.
Oh, okay.
So how does this change the governor's original proposal? Looks like you're changing the sliding fee scale for determining premiums for the Minnesota Care program.
Madam Chair, the department gave me the amendment. I am not familiar with it. They said it would bring it in line. Maybe someone would be willing to come up and deduce.
Madam Chair, I'm Christine Bronson, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. This looks to be an amendment from the Department of Health, I think amending sections of the Healthy Connections proposal.
Well, it's amending the Minnesota Care program, which is your program.
So this is
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kristen Lonkerich from the Health Department. This amendment will bring the budget bill in line with the policy language that's in Senator Rosen's Senate File 1567 so that the language matches between the two proposals.
I'm just going to ask if people can take their conversations outside. It's difficult to hear the witness. So this is not part of the governor's bill. It's just an amendment that places a bill that Senator Rosen has into the department bill. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, they're two separate bills. There's a standalone policy bill, Senate File 1567, that contains the governor's Healthy Connections policy language. The language is in two places. It's in Senate File 888, the governor's budget bill, and then also the standalone policy bill. And this amendment will just bring the policy language in line between both bills.
So they don't conform with each other for some reason?
At this moment, they do not.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I'm just going to make a brief statement, and then we will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Bronson and Margaret Kelly from the department, and they can go over those issues or the items that you had mentioned. For human services, the bill includes an increase over the 06-07 funding. And as a vehicle for the governor's proposed budget, this bill makes significant investments in human services while paying for performance, not just quantity. Strategic new investments in this bill include health reform efforts, referred to as Healthy Connections, that addresses quality, access, and cost as an initiative that improves the mental health system so that people get more effective care. And we had a good discussion last night about the mental health portion of the bill in health policy. The governor's mental health initiative invests money to improve the mental health care system. The proposal is based on the recommendations from the Minnesota Healthcare Action Group. In emphasizing pay for performance, the bill links a portion of a 2% rate increase for nursing home to quality measures. The bill also advances priorities to help vulnerable children, the elderly, and the homeless, and helps address in the short term the significant anticipated loss of federal funding supporting core county case management services for vulnerable populations. And Senate File 888 will continue our tradition of providing help at times of need with a renewed emphasis on quality and value. And I will turn it over to Christine
and
Bronson.
We will have a different day scheduled to discuss the mental health initiative.
Yes, absolutely.
So, just so we can use the time we have today as best as possible.
Madam Chair, I'm Christine Bronson, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. I did a dry run of these remarks that include everything on the list that you sent to us, and it took 30 minutes. So I will be under the hour, but I'm happy to pause for questions if you or committee members have them. Article 1 begins on page 2 with appropriations necessary to support policy changes in the governor's budget recommendation as delineated in Senate File 888. After this article is amended to reflect repricing for the February forecast and the supplemental budget, the 2008-09 biennium appropriations to DHS would be $9.5 billion in state general funds, $863 million in health care access funds, and $548 million in other direct appropriated funds. The appropriation numbers do not include non-dedicated revenue that benefits the general fund and health care access fund, such as federal administrative earnings or transfers from other funds. These non-dedicated revenues are estimated at around $400 million a year. The appropriations reflect both proposed new investments and forecasted growth in existing programs under current law. In addition to the appropriations, Article 1 contains a number of riders that direct the department to manage funds in a specific manner. Those that you have requested that we highlight include riders related to adoption assistance and relative custody assistance on page 11. The first three riders grant the department authority to utilize certain federal funding for adoption grants and foster care, and provides for flexibility in transferring the funding between the two programs and between fiscal years to help address unforeseen enrollment in the program. Specific to the governor's budget, the rider on line 18 of page 11 would authorize implementation of two changes. First, it would fund the caseload change expected in the programs in fiscal years 08 and 09, and second, it would provide for a 5% increase in payments to families. The current adoption subsidy payments are based on two schedules, the basic maintenance rate, which is determined by a child's age, and the supplemental rate, which is governed by the child's level of need. Basic rates vary from $247 to $337 for older children, and supplemental rates range from $150 to $500. The rider in the appropriations section would provide for a 5% increase in these rate schedules. The next rider I'll highlight is the temporary funding for targeted case management on page 12, line 13. The federal government is expected to issue regulations soon that will seriously curtail targeted case management funding for counties. Counties have been earning substantial federal reimbursement for providing core child welfare, mental health, and vulnerable adult protection services. We expected that counties would be receiving nearly $90 million in this fiscal year absent these changes. The governor is proposing a one-time appropriation of $40 million to assist counties and help support these needed services. These funds would be available once the impact of the federal changes can be assessed and would be allocated proportionately to earnings in calendar year 2005. Also, at the request of Madam Chair, I will point to the appropriations for budget activities on page 14. These include the appropriations for implementing the governor's recommendations for ending long-term homelessness. The long-term homelessness implementation proposal provides additional funds for supportive services, transitional housing, and program infrastructure. It's one component of a package of investments developed in coordination with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Department of Corrections. This proposal includes $1.475 million to expand the availability of supportive housing services to an additional 75 to 100 households throughout the state. $175,000 for emergency shelters to focus on transitioning people experiencing long-term homelessness into permanent housing, and $250,000 for the transitional housing program to provide additional beds where need still exists. And this piece finally provides $100,000 to expand implementation of the Homeless Management Information System to supportive housing services grantees and community action agencies. And expands the availability of web-based information. Next, on page 17, appropriations in the healthcare management budget activity include the increase associated with administrative funding for citizenship documentation. Effective July 1st of 2006, federal and state laws required that applicants and enrollees for MA in Minnesota care for families with children who declare to be U.S. citizens or nationals must provide documentation of their citizenship and identity. Previously, MA applicants verified citizenship by attesting to their citizenship and signing the healthcare application under penalty of perjury. New federal regulations are very restrictive and require specific kinds of documentation. Copies of acceptable documentation must be available in all case records, and failure to obtain documentation could result in a loss of federal MA funding. Federal regulations require that counties and Minnesota Care operations assist people who need help with obtaining documentation. Both counties and Minnesota Care operations have experienced increases in costs and case processing times since implementation of the documentation requirements. DHS has established a special unit to assist counties and Minnesota Care operations with difficult cases. Currently, agencies submit a form requesting verification of birth to the Department of Health
Excuse
or their
me,
county
just a
registrar.
Minute. Ms. Senator,
yeah, Madam Chair,
Solon, did you, are you not able to hear?
No, Ms. Bronson, I think our pages might be numbered differently. Can you tell us what article and section you're in?
Oh, my apologies. I am in the appropriations article, and my notes say page 17.
For healthcare management.
We have healthcare management. Senior Minnesota Senior Health Options Reimbursement.
It's tracking. There's no language.
This hasn't been tracking.
Maybe someone could bring Ms. Bronson a copy of what we have.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hardwick, our CFO, just informed me that this area of increased administrative funding is not listed as a line item in the budget. It is part of healthcare management activities on page 17 of the appropriations rider. So the cost of this additional burden is embedded in the healthcare management and healthcare policy administration section.
Thank you for that clarification.
DHS is in the process of developing a data match system with the Department of Health that will verify birth records for people born in Minnesota, which should help alleviate some of the processing time. But for right now, the processing time has been increased considerably.
So
effective July.
Would that then be a one-time request or a decreasing request?
Madam Chair, the request is an ongoing request, and the reason for that is that the cost of obtaining the documentation will continue to be a cost to the system. So we will still need to pay to have birth records verified, but the burden, the efficiency with which staff can do that should be improved.
So if the efficiency is improved after you get the data system going, then would there be reduced costs because of greater efficiency?
For staff. Okay, but there aren't staffing increases. Madam Chair, the costs that are represented on the page are, there's a one-time cost for developing the data match system, but the ongoing costs reflect the cost of still needing to pay even though it's an electronic match, to pay each time we match and verify a birth record.
And why do we have to pay each time?
Madam Chair, it's fairly commonplace across all states to have a small fee that is required when requesting a verified birth document, and that I believe is the same here in Minnesota, even when we do department matches with the Department of Health and verify birth records against their records. It also covers the cost of
going to other states for birth records.
I understand the other states issue, but in terms of verifying a birth record that is in Minnesota, we're just paying ourselves, right?
Madam Chair, from your perspective, yes, but across budgeting lines, the Department of Human Services would be paying the Department of Health.
So did the Department of Health anticipate increased revenues because of this change in federal law?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that, but we can certainly get back to you.
Okay. Continue.
The rider at the top of page 21 includes the base appropriation for deaf and hard of hearing grants, plus two increases resulting from change pages in the governor's budget recommendation. $389,000 in fiscal year 08 and $777,000 in fiscal year 09 for increasing services and supports for deaf-blind people, and $15,000 in 08 and $55,000 in 09 for the 2% and 2% payment adjustment for continuing care providers. This rider also authorizes a $4,000 a year base adjustment in fiscal years 10 and 11 that is included in the governor's budget.
And this increase in the request for deaf and hard of hearing grants, we have a lot of proposals this year regarding funding for deaf or hard of hearing proposals. Could you just again explain what this one does?
Madam Chair, I think I would ask Bruce Hodick to come and walk through the details of this proposal.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Hodeck. I'm the Director of Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. This proposal is an accumulation of work that we've done related to deafblind services or services for deafblind people since we convened a study group in the year 2002 to focus on services and needs for deafblind individuals. Of course, as you know, deafblind individuals are a very high-need population because they have the loss of both their vision and their hearing. Part of the process through the task force and study group is we started to identify more areas of need for this population group. And so as we're starting to see more and more senior citizens who have declining vision and declining hearing, and we're also starting to see more children with various syndromes that result in deaf blindness and that are showing up in the population. And so the funding is asking to increase our grant programs to support these people.
And when you say increase the grant program to support these people, are we increasing the amount per person or are we increasing the number of people served?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we're doing both.
And how much are we increasing the amount per person? And how many increased people will be served?
In past years, excuse me, Madam Chair and members of the committee, in past years, the money was all used for community-based programs. And the programs were primarily housed here in the metro area. But as a result of the needs of rural Minnesotans, we did establish other types of programs and a consumer-directed program where we actually give direct grants to consumers and they choose how they want to use the funding for supports. And for that particular program, their annual appropriation or a grant amount was $5,000 approximately. And this proposal will increase that to $7,000 per year.
So it increases the amount per person served that's available. Does it also increase the number of people receiving these grants?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Currently, we serve approximately 145 people, and we expect to serve an additional 80 people.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next item I'll highlight at the Chair's request is the HIV/AIDS Insurance Program appropriation. These are included in the budget activity labeled Other Continuing Care Grants on page 21, line 12. The appropriation amounts will be updated to reflect the revised change page that Jane Hardwick reviewed with you earlier this morning. And the last item that I'll mention in this article is the governor's recommendation for compensation-related costs of an increase of 2% each year of the biennium for central office and 3.25% each year for state-operated services, certain activities in state-operated services. This appropriation is represented in the management budget activities listed throughout this article. And as a final note, that's unrelated to the Department of Human Services, this article also includes all of the appropriations for the health-related licensing boards.
Any questions? Okay, let's continue.
Beginning on page 31, Article 2 would amend the child care assistance programs. The changes would include creating financial incentives for child care assistance program providers to improve school readiness of young children. These incentives would benefit approximately 600 children. excuse me. The appropriation would also improve administration and address eligibility inequities, and the related changes to MFIP child care are included in the next, the bill's next article, Article 3.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You sort of skipped over a few pages, and I wonder if I could ask for some clarification. On page 25, line 25.13, MERC, it's been brought to my attention that there are some potential changes in how MERC is handled and distributed, and I wonder if the department could clarify in each of those items 1, 2, 3, and 4 what the various components of that are and what the funding mechanism is.
Well, the MERC distribution is handled by the Department of Health. This page gets the money from PMAP over there. It's a carve out of a certain amount of our medical assistance dollars that are earmarked for medical education. So these are the medical assistance dollars that go over to the Department of Health, but they're not administered by the Department of Human Services. Okay?
Thank you.
I think we can go on then.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I would just add that the Department of Health's changes to MERC are found on page 157, and I'm sure they'd be happy to walk through those changes with you. Article 3, which begins on page 36, starts out with the change to MFIP child care that I just mentioned. It is followed by an expansion of a current law requirement to use the Federal Automatic Status Verification System, or SAVE, program to validate the immigration status of recipients of public assistance programs at application, to now require that that be validated at recertification. Much of the remainder of the article would amend MFIP to serve families with minimal employment history more effectively and to align the state program more closely with new federal policies. Both strategies would reduce the state's risk of financial penalties under the Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. The changes include providing counties and tribes with grants to develop specialized employment programs, shortening the time period that a participant is sanctioned before closing the case, requiring an employment plan prior to issuing MFIP benefits, and funding benefits for participants who are least likely to meet federal work participation requirements with a non-maintenance of effort state funds. Finally, this article would repeal the June 30th, 2007 sunset of MFIP and Diversionary Work Program cash and food assistance to legal non-citizen families. approximately 220 families would continue to be served under the proposal.
Okay, let's keep going.
Beginning on page 58, Article 4 would amend the Human Services Background Study Act to comply with new federal requirements related to background study requirements for child foster care providers and adoptive parents under the Adam Walsh Child Protection Act of 2006, a federal provision. In addition to transferring the responsibility to complete these background studies from counties and private placing agents, transferring the responsibility to complete these background studies from counties and private placing agencies to the state, this article makes the following three changes. It requires an FBI fingerprint-based record check to be completed on all individuals studied in relation to child foster care licenses. It requires a review of all 87 counties' substantiated child maltreatment findings for all individuals studied in relation to child foster care licenses. And finally, for any individual who has lived in another state in the 5 years preceding the study, requires a review of that state's data system. The language also amends the Human Services Licensing Act to change the terminology used when counties make emergency placements of children with relatives. These emergency placements would no longer be considered licensed placements. All requirements relative to the placements must continue to be made: completion of a home safety inspection and obtaining information necessary to initiate a background study. But by removing the term licensed from the description, the county is not required under the Adam Walsh Act to wait until a fingerprint-based FBI record check is completed.
In order to place a child.
Madam Chair, that's correct. In an emergency situation, place a child with a relative. Article 5 begins on page 84. It's the healthcare article. This language implements physician-directed care coordination for enrollees in MA and GAMC. This would allow the department to better manage the health issues of patients with complex chronic illnesses in a more comprehensive manner. The language following that further implements our pay-for-performance efforts. This initiative covers enrollees in both managed care and fee-for-service. DHS currently has a pay-for-performance program for enrollees with diabetes. This legislation would expand that to cardiac disease as well. Article 5, Section 5 on page 87 authorizes the continuation of payments to critical access dental providers. Low reimbursement rates have negatively affected access to dental care. Changes made in the 2001 legislative session addressed this problem by creating a special rate add-on for dentists and dental clinics in service areas with high public program utilization or underserved populations. The critical access program applies to both fee-for-service providers and providers under managed care. The CAD add-on payment is scheduled to end on June 30th of this year. This proposal would continue the additional critical access dental payments.
Ms. Bronson, could you just explain to us why this payment is not a forecasted item? I mean, it seems to me it is part of the public program dental rate. And if we have more people in our public programs using dental care, we would forecast an increase in payments due to utilization. And this is an increase that's happened over time due to utilization. So I just don't understand exactly why this is not a forecasted program.
Madam Chair, I'm not certain of the legislative history about why it grew up this way. But I would imagine...
Well, it was forecasted by the department for a number of years. And last year, for some reason, you came in and said you weren't supposed to be forecasting it, and so you're proposing cutting all the critical access dental payments in half.
Just to clarify, Madam Chair...
the appropriation.
I'm not certain of the legislative history, but we can certainly get back to you with both what we've told you in the past, if we changed it from a forecast to a grant program.
Well, it certainly is creating some problems, and I don't think it serves us very well. I think both folks in the department, folks out in the dental community, and certainly our constituents
have felt like this program has been working to expand access to dental care. And it is a payment that's made to dentists. It is matched with federal funds. I mean, it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it sounds like a duck, so why isn't it forecasted?
That's pretty good.
Madam Chair, I have a little bit of the legislative history. It appears as though the language is written in one of the recent legislative bills was, it said to, within the appropriation, this service will be provided. And the department erred at one point in forecasting that item and later realized that the legislative language did not indicate that it should be forecasted. It should be it should be within the appropriation. I agree with your assessment. There isn't a barrier to forecasting, but it would be a matter of changing the legislative language to make it a forecast and buying the appropriate fiscal effect of that.
Okay, so maybe we can figure out if we can do that or not.
We would be happy to give you technical assistance or whatever.
But it was not recommended by the department that we do that.
That is not part of the governor's proposal at this time, no. I take that back. I rescind my statement. It is scheduled to be forecasted. Madam Chair, we have bought that in the governor's budget, and it is a forecasted program. Okay. Madam Chair, the language as proposed in the governor's budget does make it a forecasted program and changes the payment rate to 33% over what they normally would be paid, which would float with the forecast.
And then it proposes to pay for it out of the health care access fund, including the forecasted amounts in the future?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
What a wonderful idea that was, huh? You almost got there, but...
Just helping to solve problems.
I think we believe we should be paying for the Minnesota Care clients that are using dental services. We should pay a critical access payment. But what would the rationale be that we should pay it for medical assistance clients out of the healthcare access fund?
Madam Chair, there are several items funded out of the healthcare access fund in the governor's proposed budget, and the rationale is that it is this being a good example. This is an underserved population of people who need dental care, and that is, by our determination, an appropriate use of the healthcare access fund.
Well, everyone in the medical assistance program is an underserved population. That's why they're in the medical assistance program.
Madam Chair, some of the balancing issues and the public policy issues around funding healthcare broadly and looking at all of our programs, both medical assistance and the Minnesota Care program funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund, is trying to balance what the needs are for both of those populations against what resources we have.
So how much is this item in the governor's budget? Medicaid portion?
And it's Medicaid? Yeah. Madam Chair, it's about $5 to $6 million a year for Medicaid clients.
So it's $10 to $12 million for the biennium?
That's correct.
All adds up, doesn't it? Okay, let's keep going.
The next section of this article provides for client medical mileage reimbursement. This proposal would link medical mileage reimbursement for clients, their neighbors, friends, and relatives to 15% below the IRS business rate rather than the fixed 20% per mile currently in statute. This would increase the payment to about 33.5 cents per mile. Beginning on page 89, sections 1 to 18 of Article 6 amends the provider waiver standards by applying the standards required under the MRRC waiver to all of the three other disability waivers. This provision helps ensure the health and safety of all waiver clients and creates a common compliance standard for providers. Section 19, 24, 26, 27, and 31 provide rate increases of 2% effective on October 1st of this year and 2% effective July 1st of next year to continuing care providers and to certain grants for people who are elderly or have disabilities. Nursing facility rates would increase by 1.5% effective October 1st and 1.5% effective next October 1st. And nursing facility rates would also be increased by an average of 0.5% per year based on a facility's performance. Sections 20, 22, 23, and 30 deal with the use of assisted living. These provisions would prevent inappropriate use of elderly waiver-funded assisted living while providing consumers who are considering moving to assisted living with information about in-home service options. The bill also seeks authority to examine private pay consumer use of assisted living that may cause premature impoverishment. Sections 21 and 29 provide access to interpreter services for deaf people by covering sign language interpreter services as a separate service under medical assistance and GAMC. Section 25 expands the scope of the nursing home report card assessment to include an additional 11 nursing homes, including 5 vets homes and 7 non-Medicaid nursing homes. This would mean that all nursing homes in Minnesota would participate in the report card. And finally, in this article, Section 28 expands the existing deaf-blind support program to provide services to an additional 80 underserved children and adults with dual sensory loss. Article 7 is the health insurance article. It begins on page 114. It addresses changes necessary to support the governor's Healthy Connection initiative. I will review the Minnesota Care components of Healthy Connections, and Margaret Kelly from the Health Department will later review the other components. Language to modernize Minnesota Care would expand access for children, expand enrollee choice, and reward healthy behaviors. Minnesota Care eligibility for children under age 21 would expand from 275 to 300% of poverty, and MA eligibility for infants under age 2 would expand to 305% of poverty. Separate Minnesota Care premium scales would be established for children and adults. Premiums for most children would be reduced by about one-third. Each enrolled adult and up to 3 children per family would be charged a premium. The current law 8% Minnesota Care premium increase would not be implemented under the proposal. Healthy Connections would enable children with family incomes between 200 and 300% of poverty to choose a subsidy to enroll in private health insurance. Enrollee premiums for this new option, Minnesota Care 2, would be half the child premium for the current Minnesota Care program. $1,500 deductible. There would be incentives under Minnesota Care and Minnesota Care 2 for healthy behavior. Q Care bonus accounts of $50 per child and $150 per family would help offset cost sharing for children with Minnesota Care 2. Children and adults on traditional Minnesota Care would reduce their premiums up to $3 a month per person or $15 per family by meeting goals for preventive care or diabetes and cardiac care. These changes would collectively be effective on January 1st of 2009. And the other components of Healthy Connections, Margaret Kelly will review later in the Health Department's presentation. Article 8, which starts on page 119, contains the language necessary to implement the governor's mental health initiative. This proposal, based on the recommendations of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, builds on 2006 legislation and includes $44 million in net new investments over the coming biennium and $37 million per year thereafter to continue improved accessibility, quality, and accountability of publicly funded mental health services.
Ms. Bronson, we'll be dedicating another day to do a hearing on this part of the proposal.
Very good. I can end my remarks there then, but I'm happy to take questions before handing it over to the Health Department for their last article.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Again, if you can just focus on the items that we had indicated we especially wanted to look at today, that would be helpful, because there are some other people who want to testify today.
Madam Chair, my name again is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and I thought I'd begin with Article 9, since that's where you are. Much of Article 9 is implementation language for the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange.
If you can just give us the page numbers.
Page 141 of the bill. And sections 1 through 4 and section 10 is implementation language for the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. Thank you. Sections 5 through 9 make changes to our Merck distribution formula. Sections 11 through 14. Sections 11 through 16 and sections 18 through 26 is implementation language for our fee changes. And section.
If you can just give us the page numbers also as you go through, because I think people will be able to stay with you better.
Page 159 is where Section 11 begins. And Section 11 through 14 is our well program fee. That's 159, 160, 161. Section 15 on page 163 is our lab specimen fee. And section 16 on page 163 is our newborn screening fee. Section 17, which begins on page 165, is language for our e-health grant program to modify the current distribution and allocation of those grants to reflect the governor's recommendation. Section 18, which begins on page 168, is a fee changes for our housing with services fee adjustment. Sections 19, 20, and 21, and 22, 23, and 24, which goes through page 170, are additional fee changes for our hearing instrument dispensers, our occupational therapists, and our mortuary science changes. Sections 27 through 31, which begins on page 171, bottom of 171, are changes for Healthy Connections that provides for Minnesota care enrollment through the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. Section 32 begins on page 174, and sections 32 through 34 establish the Minnesota Care 2 option, which is a part of the Governor's Healthy Connections proposal. Section 35, which is on page 177, is also a part of Healthy Connections. It establishes the Q-Care premium discount incentives. And section 36 on page 178 is repealers. The reference to rules repeals our mortuary science fees that are currently in rule. We replace it with a statutory fee amount. the reference to session law repeals existing language for appropriating the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder grant to MOFAS, and we replace that with a new rider in the appropriations section. The appropriations article, the section for the Department of Health, begins on page 23. And, Madam Chair, the first rider, that's TANF appropriations 23.18, is relating to our home visiting program. On this page 23 and also on page 27 under Minority and Multicultural Health, page line 27.18, these two riders together are for our family home visiting proposal, increasing that to a $9.5 million appropriation annually. The grants go out to community boards of health and to tribal governments. The next rider on line 23.28 on page 23 is for our MinEnable program, adding $1 million for the biennium to that grant program from the TANF funds to maintain the current program as it is. The next rider on line 23.32 is our loan forgiveness program. This provides ongoing funding at anticipated levels, and it consolidates the funding into the healthcare access fund. On page 24, line 24.3 is the rider for the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder grant, increasing that grant from $1.1 million annually to $2 million annually to Minnesota Organization for Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And subdivision 3 on page 24 includes funding. The first rider is for the healthcare access survey to ensure that we have biennial surveys describing what access people have in Minnesota to health insurance.
Ms. Kelly, could you just explain a little bit how you've come up with the number 600,000 for that survey?
Certainly, Madam Chair. That estimate is based on the cost of previous surveys.
And who receives the money?
Madam Chair, we will contract with the U of M to conduct that survey.
I think maybe we, if it's possible, we'd like to get a breakdown of that budget.
We can provide that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, on page 25, Merck Rider is allocating the $8 million for Merck for specific pools that we are distributing under different formulas. The first would be the education-only formula, the second would be the trainee formula, and the third would be a new pot of funds for additional training in mental health and patient safety.
And again, this is an appropriation being requested from the Healthcare Access Fund.
That's correct. Madam Chair, the rider on the bottom of page 25, Health Information Technology.
Chair Rosen had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly, what was the fourth appropriation? $2 million. What's that for? Three.
I will need to refer to language in the back. Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I misspoke on the third pot. The first pot is an MA distribution only, which is the funding follows where MA payments are. The second pot is the education distribution, which follows where training occurs. The third pot is a discretionary pot that we provide that sites can allocate how they choose. And the last pot, the $2 million, is the pool that we would distribute for innovative training in the areas of mental health and patient safety.
Madam Chair,
continuing on page.
Excuse me.
Mayor Sharon?
Yes. On this Merck, is this a redistribution of Merck dollars that are now based differently rather than where the students are trained? It's based on what were you saying? Would you discuss that again?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the current formula distributes Merck grants primarily on education. So where students are being trained is where the grant dollars flow. Federal requirements, if we are to receive federal financial participation to maintain that, we need to distribute the federal share where MA payments occur. So the first number on 25.16, the first $5 million will be used to distribute general fund or healthcare access fund and federal financial participation on an MA only formula. So sites that do more business, MA business, will receive a greater amount of funding than sites that do a smaller amount of MA business. That is a change from how we currently distribute the funds, and we would make that change to receive federal financial participation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Can you discuss the implications of that in terms of what were of those institutions that are committed to higher education training for medical students?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, we're trying to hold all sites kind of at a level playing field, and which is why we have a second pool of funds that would go out based on education or training volume, to ensure that we do provide funding in the Merck grant program for education only. So those sites that do a small amount of MA business but do a lot of training in the state would continue to get Merck funds. There will be an overall impact on how Merck dollars are distributed. We've tried to hold people harmless, hold sites harmless to the best that we can, but there will be an impact to some sites.
Ms. Kelly, it would be possible to make this correction that the federal government is asking us to make without investing $8 million more dollars, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, we could distribute all of our cigarette tax dollars on an MA-only formula, and provided the feds would continue to participate in medical education, we could receive, provided they approved the waiver, we could receive it. It would have a more significant impact on sites across the state, and it would not meet our policy goal of ensuring that dollars follow trainees, but we could.
Well, I think that was really the result of the governor's decision to cut all the Merck dollars in the 2003 budget, except for the cigarette funds and the PMAP dollars, wasn't it?
Madam Chair, the governor's budget in 2003 did eliminate the Merck endowment, but it replaced the proceeds from that endowment with cigarette tax dollars, so there was not a loss at that time for Merck.
Correct, but that decision has now resulted in the fact that we cannot spend the money the way we did because we have to comply with the federal government's requirement that when you spend medical assistance money, you're spending it at institutions that provide medical assistance benefit to patients.
Madam Chair, we were using the medical education endowment earnings to draw down federal financial participation at that time as well. And we were doing that on a primarily education formula. And so had we not made this change, we probably would still be here today with this same proposal.
But we had more non-Medicaid dollars at that time in the budget.
Madam Chair, this proposal addresses the loss of federal financial participation on transfers made from the academic university's academic health center and our cigarette tax earnings. So it's not specifically on Medicaid dollars, general fund dollars that we're trying to replace here. It's on the federal match on those non-Medicaid expenditures.
Don't you think we're going to have the same problem with the Medicaid funding?
Madam Chair, it's very likely that we will.
So wouldn't it make more sense just to fix it all at once?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's keep going.
Madam Chair, Subdivision 3, Policy, Quality, and Compliance in the State Government Special Revenue line on 24.29 includes the funding for our fee adjustments as well. On page 25, the Health Information Technology rider is for our e-health grants that distributes those grants to rural and underserved areas. Page 26, the Health Insurance Exchange rider, it provides funding for the Health Insurance Exchange. On line 26.18, Subdivision 4, Health Protection, the first rider is for pandemic influenza preparedness. The governor is recommending $12.375 million the first year, $7.375 million the second year, and $4.375 million in the tails for preparedness, public health preparedness for pan flu. $5 million will go out for purchasing antiviral medications, and $1.375 million will remain at the Department of Health for 24/7 capacity among our epidemiologists and within our laboratories. I missed the $5 million that's invested in creating a stockpile of healthcare supplies, which would be cots and ventilators and other things. The final $1 million on line 26.35 is for grants to local public health and tribal governments to ensure their capacity to be prepared as well. Included in the general fund appropriation for health protection on line 26.20 is funding for TB prevention to ensure that we have sufficient medications distributed, to ensure that local public health has the funding for case management, and to provide additional funding at MDH's laboratory for lab analysis of the increase in TB cases around the state. Included in the general fund appropriation is also money for the MDH laboratory operations to ensure we have money in our budget to meet the increase in rent from the Department of Administration and to provide the additional services we need just for basic operations of our new laboratory building. Madam Chair, on page 27, line 27.14, is the appropriation for the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, and the TANF rider there is the other piece of the home visiting program that goes out to tribal governments. And in subdivision 6 on page 27, administrative support services, includes funding for the first rider is for disease surveillance, and that is funding for our internal surveillance systems that are primarily paper-based or separate electronic systems that we need to bring up to compliance with federal FIN requirements and to meet the requirements and expectations of the provider community out there for electronic exchange and to work with local public health around electronic exchange of our data with them.
Sure. And maybe you could just explain to us one more time why this is not a one-time investment.
Madam Chair, it is a one-time investment over a period of 4 years. And base funding then in the 12 and 13 biennium, which is not included in the budget, but base funding then is $500,000, and I believe the rider, or $600,000, the rider on page 28, the last part of the rider, sets the base level for the 2012-2013 biennium at $600,000 to pay for operation costs of the new systems, maintenance contracts, licensing agreements for the systems that we purchase. And included in all of the general fund, healthcare access fund, and state government special revenue appropriations throughout the bill is the compensation adjustment for state for salaries for employees, 2% in each fund.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Boy, we just have maybe a minute or two for the people that wanted to testify. Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, could I ask one question? Could you explain the Minnesota CARE 2 program?
Madam Chair, I'm not the best person to ask. I think I will defer to Scott Lights for that one.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Scott Lights with the State Health Department. Senator Pretner Solon, your question was regarding Minnesota CARE 2. Minnesota CARE 2 is a program that would run parallel to the Minnesota CARE program that is currently in existence. It'd be available for children with incomes between 200 and 300% of poverty. It would be an optional program that they could choose or their parents could choose to enroll them in as opposed to original Minnesota CARE. The way it would operate is that the premiums that would be set for Minnesota CARE 2 would be set at approximately 1/6 of the current level of premium for children in Minnesota CARE. And children enrolling in that program would have access to individual market products that are currently being sold. The Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange would have responsibility for establishing the sort of base benefit set for that program, but we envision it being a modest deductible program, so there would be some cost sharing on the front end with benefits that are roughly equivalent to benefits that are currently under the Minnesota CARE program. There would be an option for insurance companies operating in the individual market. If you had more than 3% of the market, you would be required to offer that standard benefit to Minnesota CARE 2 enrollees, but you'd also be allowed to offer up to three other actuarially equivalent plans. So plans that have the same sort of dollar value of benefit could also be offered to those enrollees. Eligibility for that program, again, would run between 200 and 300% of poverty for children, and it would be an option for people to enroll their children in.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lights, it would be the commercial market that would be providing the coverage?
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner Solon, that's correct.
And I think we established on a $40,000 a year family of three that they could have a deductible of anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000.
And Madam Chair, is it only for the children?
Yes. Okay. Any other questions? If not, I think we're not going to have time for testimony. If you wanted to testify, I would encourage you to give us a letter, and we will distribute it at our next committee meeting to all of the members of the division. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
That's another one of those proposals. And we should have asked, I suppose.